Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. I think Peter's still talking somewhere, maybe on hold. Does he know the segments? Anyway, don't forget our live coverage of the Iowa caucuses tonight. I'll be anchoring beginning at 8 o'clock on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC and WNYC.org. This is the same coverage that they'll be hearing in Iowa as we team with the Iowa Public Radio news team. So it should be really exciting tonight at 8 o'clock, AM 820, 93.9 WNYC.org for Iowa caucuses coverage. Let's meet an interesting man now who has led a successful and unusual life. His name is Wynn Straub. He grew up in Germany and as a teenager survived the bombing of Dresden by the Allies near the end of World War II. He later moved to the United States, becoming an interpreter for the State Department. He owned his own engineering products company, became a pilot, a lawyer, and later a renowned teacher of Tai Chi. Also in his 70s, a gold medal swimmer in the Senior Olympics. Wynn Straub's work these days is to head his own foundation that specializes in promoting distance learning programs, and to that end he has a new book called QGE equals A, which stands for Quality Generic Education is the Answer, published by the University Press of America. And let's talk to this interesting man. Wynn Straub, welcome to WNYC. Good morning.
Good morning. My pleasure.
I'm curious about your book, but also about your life. You were a German teenager growing up in Dresden during World War II. What was it like to be a kid in Nazi Germany, and what was it like when the city was leveled by Allied firebombing?
This is very well described in a book which is out of print by the name of Enjoying the Ride.
That's your autobiography.
Yes. But
I did notice on Amazon they have a couple you can pick up used, but
correct.
Go ahead.
Correct. It's a long story, but the key element is I survived. And maybe I matured a little faster than I would have otherwise.
That attack, if I may ask you one question about
yes.
it, is often cited as a moral black mark against the Allies, despite the overall obvious rightness of the cause of World War II, because the city itself included the civilian population that was also a target. How have you come to think about the attacks that destroyed your hometown?
I think that war is war, and it is easy for people after the war to double guess on what should have been done or should not have been done. I think it's the same question as to whether Hiroshima should have been bombed with an atomic bomb or otherwise. So I think it's not up to us to double guess those decisions at the time. And it is really water over the dam. And as fact, I think it's not a moral issue for us to decide. And I think that the people who made this decision at the time did this in good conscience. And moral of the whole war and how it came about and what was done, I think the Germans committed so many crimes and pursued immoral attacks, for instance, on Coventry, where the whole air war sort of started, that it is normal, I think, that reactions which will end up in the carpet bombing of German cities is the result. So I think it's not so much a moral question. It's just, it happened.
Did you have to go through a process afterwards, having been a child growing up during the Nazi era in Germany, to come to grips with what had happened at the leadership level of your country?
Yes. But I would say it is a process which took some time, and in fact, it started already during the war itself. but or even before the war, as you will find in my book, Enjoying the Ride, the biggest secret of my family, and which of course now is no secret anymore, was that we have Jewish roots, and we lived through a very anti-Jewish situation.
So you're a Jewish Holocaust survivor from Nazi Germany. They didn't get you.
Correct.
How did you wind up in the United States and working for the State Department?
Easy. I became an interpreter in Germany, and I worked, and I was, in fact, I was the assistant to the U.S. Treasury representative in Germany at the time. His name is Horace A. Brown, and they picked me as an interpreter for the State Department and moved me to the United States. So this is how I came here for
right.
the first time.
Now, you've owned a technology sales firm and run an international engineering company, became a pilot and a patent lawyer, and I haven't even gotten to your life as a Tai Chi instructor and education advocate. Is there a common thread that ties your various careers together?
Well, I think it's really one career. And the career is to advance my personal understanding of the world and of what I can contribute in this world. And I think in today's world, this is very much a matter of technology, of advancing technology. And this has been my life.
And in fact, your new book is about this concept that you call quality generic education, and technology is very involved in that, correct?
Correct.
Tell us about that.
Yes. Well, the effect our education system, the way it works today still, is very much, I would say, maybe 2,000 years old. It is teaching a classroom of people. Or it evolved into this. While today you could teach the whole world from one TV studio, provided you had the right kind of setup, and the pupils were paying attention. In other words, it's a matter of to learn, you got to be present. Not necessarily in person, but your mind needs to be present. So the issue is how to connect your learning mind with the teacher. And nowadays, again, this is possible to have the best teachers in the world provide the knowledge to essentially everyone. And this is what this book is all about.
Ah, so even though people may consider it kind of cold and maybe even dehumanizing to do education in front of a television monitor or a computer monitor, you're saying that an advantage of that would be that there would be fewer teachers and only the best ones would be doing the job?
Yeah, well, as I explained in the book, there are going to be different versions of teachers. The one teacher who is making the presentation is the one, Brian Lehrer, teaching to the rest of the nation and having the audience. However, there is another group of teachers in front of him, which would be the ones who prepare the material to be taught. And this is very essential. In other words, that you have the best materials to work from and to teach. And the ones who would develop the tests, like the people who would work for educational testing services in Princeton. So these are all, in essence, teachers. Now, on the other side, would be teachers at the station of where the message is being received. In other words, in front of this monitor or a classroom with a monitor, a teacher would be present, or it could be the parent or other, I call them facilitators.
If you have teachers present in the room, why do you need the TV monitors?
Well, because of the of what is being transmitted. In other words, the teacher in the room may not have the qualifications or the knowledge which is being transmitted.
It's a very centralized view of education then, right? It's one that believes that expertise can be disseminated by the experts more effectively than trying to have, you know, in New York we have 80,000 teachers just for one city's public school system, more than relying on them as much as we do today. Do I understand it correctly?
Well, let's take the example of pilot training. If you have to learn how to fly a specific airplane, you better get the correct instructions and from hopefully the best instructor you can have for this. And it doesn't matter where this instructor is located, so as long as this message reaches you. However, if you leave this, or if you had 20,000 teachers or something like this dissipating the same information, and assuming they don't have all the same knowledge and not the same qualifications, then this message will become quite different.
Are you talking about all ages, by the way, or only older kids or higher education?
I'm talking about all ages.
You are?
Yes.
Well, let me take a caller who wants to question that, I think, for younger children. Joshua,
okay.
In Greenwich, you're on WNYC with Wynn Strawbe, author of Quality Generic Education. Hi, Joshua.
Hi. I'm an elementary school teacher in Greenwich, and I actually have the pleasure of working in two buildings, so I'm driving from one school to another right now. and as much as I would like to...
A mobile prep period, right?
Yes, exactly. And instead of, I mean, as much as I would like to beam myself into these classrooms and stay at home possibly in my bed, I think a lot of what's being said is operating under this largely accepted fallacy that for each discipline we have, there is one right way to teach it or one method
or
to everything we
right,
do.
Or one best way.
Yeah, and that's, I mean, that's the whole reason.
Right. I'm going to leave it there and ask our guest, do you believe that as he stated it?
No. The aspect, there are quite a number of things which cannot be taught long distance. For instance, if you had to do laboratory work in chemistry or things like this, definitely you'd have to do this in person. And you may have disadvantaged children who need far more than an image to learn from. Mm-hmm. And obviously, so this would have to be dealt with this way.
Dude.
However, even I would assume that in a school, or if you have, like your listener reported, two of them where you're teaching, that and even and particularly for small children, you may have presentations in there, like from Sesame Street or Sesame Workshop, which are essentially distance learning methods.
Right.
While the rest goes on. So in other words, I'm not saying that 100% of the time, and that in all cases, there's only one way of how knowledge can be dissipated. Not at all.
I'm curious to get back to your life for a minute and ask you how you got interested in Tai Chi, which sounds kind of alternative for a guy who was working in technology transfer and patent law.
That's a good idea. But I, in the course of developing my business, we have branches and offices in different parts of the world, including in Singapore. And when I opened up that office in Singapore, my wife and I, we lived there. My wife is doing Tai Chi. My wife is doing yoga. I always thought Tai Chi is a nifty thing to do. So I had the opportunity in Singapore to really study this. And as it turned out, I became part of the Singapore exhibition, national exhibition team in Tai Chi. I even starred in their movie, which they play at their science center, which is called Homeland. I'm doing the Tai Chi. So this is how I got involved, and I love it, and it's a very good counterbalance for the hectic life in which I'm living otherwise.
We just have a minute left. What do you hope that your foundation will accomplish?
That the purpose of the foundation is to show and to accomplish how anyone, anywhere, can obtain a high-quality, world-class education at the least amount of expense or at no cost at all.
Wynn Strobe is the head of his own foundation, which does focus on distance learning, and he is the author now of QGE equals A, which stands for Quality Generic Education is the Answer. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in a minute, the New York City food co-op movement. It isn't just for Park Slope anymore.